Welcome to Public Services International's podcast series. My name is Trimita Chakma, and I'm the host of this episode. For this episode, I had the pleasure of interviewing three Wahi Maori unionists who have been leaders in a network of 10,000 Maori members of the Public Service Association in Aotearoa, or New Zealand. This story shows the power of women's leadership in the collective struggle to protect Indigenous workers' rights in workplaces around New Zealand. Georgina Kerr, Leslie Dixon, and Marcia Puru tell us about their involvement in the Mana Wahinwai 2864 claim to challenge discrimination and racism against Maori women in the workplace. They tell us about how they're using their collective power to improve conditions of Maori workers in the public sector and create change for future generations. Georgina Kerr is a kuia, or elder, and one of the main claimants of the Mana Wahin claim. Georgina has been inspirational in the movement for all women, but especially Maori women within the PSA. She is a leading voice in addressing inequalities for Maori, and in particular women, in all sectors of the workforce, as well as in education, housing inequalities, and poverty. Leslie Dixon is a mental health worker specifically for Maori people. She has been a member of the PSA for 30 years and a delegate for about 12. She is a Maori Enterprise Delegate, a voice for Maori people within the PSA structure. She is also the first Maori Vice President of the PSA. And finally, Marcia Puru is part of the Waikato Tainui tribe. She started off as a delegate within the PSA and has advocated for Maori people, becoming an organizer for Maori within her union. I asked our guests about their first experience when they recognized there was systemic racism against Maori women.
For me, it started right through at school when I was 10. So I came from the East Coast, and they're very small schools and very small Maori communities. So I was a bit fortunate because I was taught by aunts and uncles. Does that make sense? Because my teachers were my aunts and my uncles. So I did really well in that environment. And so because I was doing very well, I sat a scholarship. So I won a scholarship, and they sent me away to school at 12 years old because they thought I would have more opportunities. So because I came from this little village, this small village, I entered this very big school in the city, and they immediately put me in the lowest achieving class, because the assumption was that children who came from those parts of New Zealand couldn't read or couldn't write. So I have had a very good grandmother. I lived with my grandmother, and if it wasn't for her, they would have left me in that class. So you see, so I felt that huge discrimination at age 12.
I was, like Georgina, brought up in a little town on the East Coast, not far from where Georgina was brought up from. And, you know, the population was probably more Māori than Pākehā at the time. I had a Pākehā mother. So my experience was a wee bit different. I went to a Māori school, a Maramutu Māori school, but my mother used to push us too. You know, if we spoke incorrectly, she would make sure that we spoke correctly and stuff like that, because she, you know, she had said, you need to get on in the world that you're living in. When I was about 18, she sent me down to Christchurch to live with an uncle and auntie, because she did not want me brought up in the town that I was brought up in. Lots of domestic violence, drugs, alcohol, and lots of people on benefits. So she just said to me, you're not staying here. I experienced discrimination at high school when I was about 14 from a different angle. My mother came to school to watch us play sport, and we were all these little wee six of us running around at high school, and my mum's white, and I had kids come up to me and say, oh God, is that your mother? And that was the first time I probably experienced or realised that there was discrimination. And it goes compared to Indigenous people as well as white people. So, yeah, that was my first experience.
Well, I suppose as a public servant myself, Tramita, back in 16 years ago, It was you could tell there was discrimination. You could tell you were being treated differently to others. And I'll give you an example. You know, trying to get into a leadership role within my workplace was really difficult for Indigenous people, but Māori women and Māori in general. So for me, that's when we started to realise biases and discrimination was being applied. And as an employee, especially wahine Māori, how we were able to raise that in a safe way, you know, because managers obviously have their discretion as to whether or not you're good enough to step in these roles, and also whether they're equipped or capable to support you to get there. There wasn't a lot of that support. And of course, another real relevant one was sitting next to your colleague. You know, you're Māori. They might be Pākehā, but they're doing the same role as you. However, they're getting paid more than you. We only know that through conversation, you know. We're not to know that actually they've been applied different rates. And we struggled, well, I struggled with that because I didn't think, A, that was fair. and how we were going to overcome that, because as Māori, we didn't feel comfortable saying so. As Māori, we weren't free to speak out like that, just in case of, you know, reprimandation or something like that. Māori wahine didn't have that confidence, or Māori in general didn't have that confidence due to, you know, I said the ramifications of what the employer might do. So that's when I started to realise there's disparities within my workplace. And it was you know, typically Pākehā in the public service, because predominantly there was all Pākehā within the workplace. So you started to see that there wasn't a high lot of, you know, recruitment of Māori or at the time. That may have changed now, which is great, but at the time, that was when I recognised, actually.
It certainly is a huge story, and these experiences are echoed throughout the Māori community. I was curious to learn what led them to take action when so many remained voiceless. Was there a trigger that motivated them to fight back?
I was 15. I made the decision then that I wasn't going to put up with it anymore, so I formed a group of the Māori, of my Māori colleague, you know, peers in the class, and we approached our principal of the school and said we weren't going to, because we were all split up. They didn't like us being together in the one class because we were too vocal, too noisy. And there are lots of things about being Māori that is wonderful. You know, we love being together. We love sharing food. We love our own company. And we're quite a force to be reckoned with when you are together. So the discrimination was really clear at secondary school. So they split you up across classes. Mm. Does that make sense? So for me, it's been a constant battle to actually... Now, I've actually done very well out of the system because I had a lot of fight and a lot of... And I had a grandmother that was very supportive, that encouraged me. So, yeah, so I did really well at school and did really well in tertiary education as well. But it was because of my own background that I've continued to work in places like unions and, you know, within Teachers College at university. And that's where the emergent groups of our language started to emerge. When I was in the 60s. So all our Māori university students started to get together and say, enough's enough.
That's really.
So I've been part of that whole transformation as well as a young student.
I think the journey for me, really, really hardcore, was probably 12 years ago when I first became a union delegate, because you just get in this world where you just work. And until you get into a union or PSA and people are organised, this is when you start hearing a lot of the issues that are going on for people.
But the biggest one really was around, and I don't know if you know this, it's called bereavement leave in Pākehā. It's around tangihanga. We call it tangihanga leave. And for Māori, when we do experience death or tangihanga in our bereavement in our world, it is definitely different to the way in which Pākehā would do their bereavement. So ours would go 3 to 4 days. And we're at a marae. So that's a marae is a communal where that person's from, and we'd actually go and hold that process on a marae, and it allows people to come and see the deceased, our whānau member, and that whole experience on what we do, the employer didn't actually know about it and didn't understand it. They just thought that we were asking for 4 days off. But, not, you know, 4 days off. Now, who does that? That wasn't a challenge in itself. What we realised, Tramita, is that actually this wasn't just a one-off. This was pockets across the organisation, across New Zealand, when we did raise it. So we did a survey. We surveyed Māori around, you know, hey, is this a one-off thing happening in certain areas, or is it across the New Zealand, across the workplaces? And we found out that actually it was happening across the workplaces. So it was a way in which that clause was applied, and people accessing tangihanga leave. So it was up to a manager as to whether or not they'd grant them 1 day, 2 day, or 3 days. And depending on how closely related that deceased or person is, will determine how long you get off. You know what I mean? How long you get to disperse, you know, or be a part of that process. And for Māori, that just was not an option, you know, especially if it was a very close family member, parent, grandparent, you know, child, all that. We believed that our process was sacred to us, and it is a cultural thing for us to be able to enact for the final departing of that deceased. And it was very clear that there was inconsistencies being applied across the organisation. So we gathered together to actually, you know, not demand, but we forced the employer to talk about it because it was a national, we showed it was a national issue for Māori, and we wanted to correct that. So what it meant was having those conversations, identifying what the issues are.
The Treaty of the Waitangi was signed in 1840 between the British Crown and Māori chiefs that confirmed formal settlement of Pākehā, or European settlers, on Aotearoa. According to Māori women, the treaty marked the point at which Māori women's leadership roles in the pre-colonial Aotearoa were erased. The Crown deliberately excluded Māori women chiefs from signing the treaty due to their colonial sexist attitude toward women. This undermined their authority and disrupted the balance that existed between Māori men and women. From the beginning, the principles set out in the treaty, partnership, participation, and protection, have either not been upheld or it has been used for the benefit of the Pākehā to the detriment of Māori, who represent 16.5% of New Zealand's 4.7 million population. The colonization of Aotearoa led to discrimination and systemic racism against Maori people for many generations. Introduction of diseases, land alienation, cultural marginalization, and deliberate destruction of culture and language has entrenched inequalities in the country. For instance, Maori life expectancy is 7 to 7.4 years less than non-Maori. The median income for Maori is 71% that of Pākehā. 25.5% of Maori leave upper secondary school with no qualifications. And over 50% of the prison population is Maori. I asked Marcia how central was the Treaty of Waitangi in her struggle and how did she learn about it?
So we heard through our parents, our grandparents, our parents, so it's been talked down to us, really. It's not something we learnt, but it was told by our parents, our tupuna, our grandparents, so three generations. To be honest, Tramita, where I would have heard it as part of my family. What I also heard about it through my grandparents' eyes is that it didn't mean for anything. Right? It didn't mean anything for them because their experiences living in that era, I guess way back, and hearing it from their parents and grandparents, they became victims of colonisation, right? So even though in Māori communities back then in rural areas is where we were living, on our marae based, you know, living within our hapu, which is our sub-tribes of groups or regional groups of Māori people. They were strapped. I mean, my grandparents talk about it when they were alive to me, that they were strapped when they were speaking Māori, their language. So they couldn't speak their language, or they would be strapped at school. So as you can imagine, that would have been a really, like, it's a flow-on effect to their kids and their kids and their mokus and grandchildren to what we know today, you know what I mean? They couldn't speak it, therefore they were colonised by the fact that, actually, I'm not going to teach my children this either. They're not going to learn how to speak Māori because they will be strapped, you know? So it had a flow-on effect to us. But, I mean, that's where I heard about the treaty. But I also heard that the treaty meant nothing to them. It meant nothing to them because it meant nothing to the government at the time.
Since 1975, a Waitangi tribunal has been used to consider claims by Māori against the state for breaches of their principles, to address prejudice against Māori and provide recompense. Public Service Association, PSI's affiliate representing 80,000 workers in the public sector, conducted a survey of its Māori women members in 2019. The survey revealed disturbing levels of bias, racism, and discrimination, and led to the launch of a Mana Wahine campaign to gain redress for Māori women workers. Of the 80,000 members of PSA, around 10,000 are Māori. I asked Marcia, what motivated her to join the PSA in the first place?
Well, you know what? I joined the union because I received a pack, right? I received a pack that had a collective agreement in there, and it had a joining form, and I was like, oh, I had no idea what that meant, right? So I was like, okay, better read this. When I opened the collective agreement, I wanted to know what does this mean for me, like as a Māori person, you know? Is this a good place, or do they respect the treaty? Lo and behold, when I read it, I went, oh, gosh, they do have a treaty clause here. That's really, like, to me, I was excited about that. And then I had looked further, and they did have bereavement leave clauses, because that's very important when our people pass away, that we're able to contribute to that process. And the only other thing was about our leave, like the leave, which I was only worried about. So I thought that was really, really awesome. I did tick, because you had to, like, join within the first 30 days. You could opt out if you wanted. And then I guess I did an induction. The union came and did a presentation. I asked them if they did anything for Māori, and they went, well, yes, we do. And so they mentioned that they had a structure there for Māori within the union that I could engage with, and I thought, oh, that's even better. You know, if you're going to pay fees for something, you might as well make sure there's something in it for you. That was definitely one highlight that I thought, that's really good. So I signed the dotted line.
To ensure Māori perspective at all levels and to promote the interests of Māori members, Te Runanga o Ngā Toa Ahina was created within the PSS structure. Georgina was there at its inception. I asked her how it all came together.
So it emerged initially through the regions of the union. Does that make sense? It didn't emerge through sectors, like whether you worked in the education sector or worked in the public sector. What it emerged initially came through through our regional structures. Now that was quite a force to be reckoned with. It became quite a strong force, but the union, I'll call it hierarchy at the time, couldn't cope with that. So they restructured, and we are now operating in sectors. Does that make sense? So the Runanga has very strong membership across all sectors. So let's name the sectors. There's the public sector.
Yep.
Which is mainly public servants,
yep,
who are employed by the government. We have the local government, which are councils.
Yeah.
And Leslie belongs to the health sector, which has got huge numbers of Indigenous employees.
Yeah, which is the district health boards.
Yeah.
Did you say Leslie's community public service?
Yeah.
state sector and public service.
Yeah. So we now operate, I think, really effectively now across all those sectors, Trim.
Yeah.
So the Rūnanga has emerging, and I have to say the leadership that comes through the sectors are mainly through our women's Māori Women's Network, but we also have some amazing men that come through as well.
It wasn't an easy journey. It took 40 years to get it properly established.
Yeah, 40. And because we are part of the governing structure of the union, which means that we sit alongside the board, the executive board. So we work very hard to we respect that thing. We work very hard to keep ourselves there, don't we, Leslie?
Yes, yeah.
So not a lot happens in the union without some consultation or some conversation with the Rūnanga. That's how well established it is now.
PSA Rūnanga's Y2864 claim is a renewal of the Manawahin Kaupapa Inquiry, or Y2700, which was first filed in 1993 by a group of Maori women leaders, alleging that the state deliberately and systematically oppressed Maori women since 1840. This inquiry, formally initiated in December 2018, found evidence of prejudice to Maori women as a result of treaty breaches by the Crown, with a significant pay gap of 23% between Pakeha men and Wahin Maori. Data from the Ministry of Women in 2018 shows the pay gap for Maori women is 18%, compared to the national gender pay gap of 9.4%. The same figures show Maori women face an unemployment rate of 11%, compared to the national rate of 4.5%. The strong campaigning led to the government pledging $6.2 million in July 2019 to support the inquiry and make amends for the colonial injustices. The tribunal decided to take a chronological approach to the inquiry, recognizing the issues affecting Wahin Maori in employment involve both historical and contemporary breaches, including discrimination and racism against Maori women. I asked how the claim got started, and if they would say the claim has been a success so far?
The claim was initiated by Tania De Whenua, which I thought you may want to have a conversation with her. She is our lawyer, and she approached the union. Oh. Now, you have to understand the Mana Wahine claim is not only about employment. You know, there are Māori women that have got claims in for other areas, other parts of our, you know, our society, you know, through
women and gangs and like that. Yeah, health.
Versus, you know, different people, tribal groups for different reasons. So the employment part of our claim is actually noted as a contemporary claim. Does that make sense? It's not a historical claim, it's a contemporary claim. And so Tania approached the Rūnanga and asked if we would be interested, because she thought it would be great to have a employment perspective brought before, because of the injustices and, you know, known injustices that Māori women, Wahine Māori, have experienced over the years, which included her and other people, you know. So she explained the process to us, and that's, she came and we thought about it. And so she made the suggestion that you have no more than four claimants. And so that's how we got to find out about it. So we started to then learn about the tribunal more intimately. We've all known about the Waitangi Tribunal. Some of us have had other experiences with historical claims, land claims. But this is quite different, this claim. It's contemporary in its whole framework.
There are now other campaigns that came out of the Mana Wahin claim, one of them being the Campaign Against Racism.
Yeah, so we just had approval to begin that process, our campaign. So that's the next part where we are galvanising all our Rūnanga delegates right across the country with support from a lot of other union members who are non-Māori union members. We've got huge support for this claim. And it really is about calling out the racism and, you know, and bias and all sorts of things that are happening in the workplace. So that campaign is about to begin and will really hit, I think it'll really start to move right at the beginning of next year, where we will be, we are at the moment sort of just planning that campaign. And it will impact, I think, union-wide on the other parts of our membership, if that makes sense. You know, it's not only happening to Māori women in the workplace, it's also happening to other people. But our major focus is about Māori women initially for that claim. So that those are the next steps. The next thing is that we do want this claim to move on. So our lawyer's pretty good at trying to hurry things up. We may initiate some more research, you know, in different aspects of our work. That's something in the pipeline if we can get funding for that. So the work is just continuing. We've got a huge, we're having really good conversations about with our Kaihautū Māori, the new position, about training our delegates, you know, so that they're more in tune with the broader perspective of political life.
So that brings me to my last set of questions. Marcia, what are your hopes for the future?
I think when I think about the future, I think of having a, you know, making our country, I would like to see the day when we have true treaty partnership. Mm-hmm. If we're not at the table making those decisions alongside, you know, we'll still be doing the same thing, influencing where we can. So I think I would like to see a true treaty partnership here in New Zealand, that Māori are able to sit at the table and make, you know, decisions jointly, and actually find solutions for our people, you know, working with our people because we understand them, and having those solutions for them as well. And it's for the betterment of our whānau, our tamariki, Trinita. It's really important for my daughter that she lives in a world that might change in that light. Yeah. It might be good for us to have that treaty partnership. Well, I hope to see it for my daughter. I hope to see that Māori are sitting at the highest table to make those decisions alongside, you know, best interest for our people. But that we're able to carry our cultural values with us, you know, that they're respected just as much. And I know my daughter, if I teach her right, will do the same thing. She will carry her head up high, just like her mum, and she will carry those values around because I've taught her to. So that's what I inspire for my daughter, but also for Māori Dung. Yeah.
As a wrap-up of my conversation with these three extremely inspiring leaders, I asked, what tips would they share with other Indigenous workers to elevate First Nation issues and representations around the world?
For me, it is get the idea, get it between your teeth and run with it. You need to have the voice. Stand up. It's about standing. Standing up for what you believe in and run with it. If you can use your union to do it, all good. But, and it's about not being frightened to have your say and to stand up. So that's it for me. It's just about get the bit between your teeth and run with it. Yeah, regroup, organise yourself. Yeah, because you're strong in numbers. As a collective, and we're a Māori, we're very collective people, strong in numbers.
I think my thing with my experiences with the PSI is what I think is hugely important, the three tips is to retain your culture and your identity, you know, in whichever way you can, really. I've sat in forums like in Japan, you know, with our Anu whānau are really struggling at times because they're not. So I think that's for me. It's just to continue feeling good about your culture, feeling good about who you are, and really if you can do that and move on from there, I think it just makes a huge difference. Networking is important.
Yeah,
and every way you can is to network. You know, for all different. I think that's really I had a good network going at one stage, but a lot of people have retired like me now, so I've lost a lot of my network people. They've all moved on. Yeah, so it is continuing on, really. And I think it's people like Leslie and I, we know we've got to get time back to our people because we've been hugely advanced and advantaged with our own education. So,
And see, a wee bit for me too, I need to keep the momentum going because in my current position that I sit at, I've only got 2 more years to go.
Mm.
It's a bit like time is running out, so I need to, yeah.
But there's huge, huge benefits in being, you know, I think for me there's a huge thing in really making the best use of retired Indigenous workers. You know, for me I've got time now, you know, I've got lots of time. And I think of people that, you know, you could capture those networks back in and bring them back in as mentors and all sorts, you know, there are all sorts of ways of
Utilise them, yep.
Utilising them. So I think it's an untapped resource, really.
3 tips I would probably give to Indigenous people, you know, all First Nations and representation with our union is that, you know, you need to be the voice for your people, you know. You need to be it. Because if you're not it, who's going to do it? And standing up for what you believe in is really important, especially kaupapa Māori, cultural values, and strong family constructs with whānau, community, iwi and hapū. So iwi is our people, hapū is our regional groups, and being that voice. The second point I would say is engaging with those same groups, right? How do we collectivise around the issues that are important to Māori and bring those to the forefront with our people, making sure you've got, you know, strong structures, but strong support within the community, iwi and hapū, in our workplaces, for sure. So you could even create the campaigns, you know, to bring those issues to the forefront. That's what's important, like we're doing for the Mana Wahine campaign. And the third thing I'd probably say is, yeah, in order to influence that for our people, just keep staying at it, you know, build resilience. Build our resilience so that we can continue to do this important kaupapa, you know, this important work for our people and what's best for them. Yeah, those would be the 3 things.
That's amazing. Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
A series of Taupapa hearings began in 2021 for the Crown to hear historic and contemporary grievances relating to policy, practice, acts and omissions, as well as the intergenerational effects of colonization and the negative socioeconomic impacts on Wahine Māori. These hearings will set the foundations for the Mana Wahine Kaupapa inquiry to explore remedies for the breaches and their consequences on Wahine Māori. It is noteworthy that Aotearoa endorsed the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples in 2010, but it is yet to ratify ILO Convention 169, Indigenous and Tribal Peoples Convention. With support from the PSA and with the strong leadership of the Runanga, Māori workers are organizing to challenge the generational harm done to Wahine Māori through colonial legacies. They are asserting the principles of the treaty and demanding an end to the systemic discrimination and racism against Indigenous workers in the workplace. Before colonization, Wahine Māori were strong and respected members of their tribe as spiritual and political leaders. Wahine Māori are reclaiming their power through strong union organizing, through solidarity, and a determination to leave a legacy of future generations of Wahine Māori in Aotearoa.